Today we're talking with Elizabeth Romer, who is a PhD and a professor of psychology at the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Her areas of specialty are anxiety disorders, cognitive behavioral treatments, and mindfulness and acceptance. Dr. Romer's research focuses on understanding how people respond to unwanted emotional experiences in ways that make them better or worse. She applies this understanding to the treatment of anxiety disorders, particularly generalized anxiety disorder and post-traumatic stress disorder. She's collaborated with a colleague on developing an acceptance-based behavior therapy for generalized anxiety disorder that incorporates mindfulness strategies. Her self-help book is The Mindful Way Through Anxiety, Break Free from Chronic Worry and Reclaim Your Life. And we'll be talking about mindfulness and acceptance-based behavioral therapy for generalized anxiety and comorbid disorders. Dr. Romer, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Can you talk first about what you mean by mindfulness?
Sure. So mindfulness is essentially a way of paying attention. It's paying attention on purpose, in the present moment, and with compassion or curiosity. And this is different from the way that we're often paying attention. So often we don't really know where our minds are going, and they're sort of being pulled by a number of different things. And mindfulness doesn't stop that, but what it does is it gives us an opportunity to kind of notice that that's happening and gently shift our awareness to the places we want to shift our awareness, or noticing what's coming up and relating to what our thoughts are or our feelings in a different way. Not critically, which is something that comes up really often for people, but instead with compassion or care or curiosity.
So specifically, can you talk about mindfulness skills and how people learn to apply them to their daily living?
Yeah, so, and mindfulness is a skill, so I appreciate you using that word, that it's, as I said, we engage in habits. We have habitual ways of responding, and often we have a habit of mindlessness. And so, but we can develop through practice the skill of being mindful. And this can be done in a number of different ways. So people can do more what we might call formal practices, and this would include things like meditation. And these are certainly practices also that draw from other traditions, such as the Buddhist tradition is a place that mindfulness comes from. Or people might also do more informal practices, so things like mindfully eating an orange and really noticing while you're eating it and paying attention to it, and of course your mind wandering off and then coming back again, noticing what it tastes like, what it smells like as you're eating it, noticing your hunger, those types of things. And then gradually expanding out, because of course the goal, if we're working with anxiety or working with depression, is not that we can eat an orange mindfully, but that perhaps we could give a talk in front of a group of people mindfully, or meet a new person with awareness and sort of without as much reactivity.
So the term acceptance, or acceptance-based behavioral therapy, can you talk about that?
Yeah, acceptance-based behavioral therapies is a term that that we use, and particularly that Sue Arcillo, my collaborator, and I have used to describe really a class of therapies, and so a group of different therapies that share some commonalities. And at their core, they're behavioral. And what that means really is that we see anxiety and depression and other kinds of reactions that people are having as learned, as habits. As making sense in given the context, given what people have had happen to them, given their biologies, these sort of patterns have developed. And what therapy can do is help to develop new patterns that are going to help people to live the lives that they want to be living. So that's kind of the behavioral side of it. The acceptance-based side of it gets to that thing I was starting to talk about that we have a tendency, all of us, and particularly those of us who are struggling with anxiety or struggling with depression, often have a tendency to respond to our own internal experiences, our thoughts or our feelings or sensations, like accelerated heart rate or palm sweating, with criticism and reactivity in a very non-accepting way. And again, we learn this, we get messages like this, you're supposed to push those thoughts away or feel better, those kinds of things. And the reality is what research has shown us, what clinical experience has shown us, what our clients have taught us, is that that doesn't really work. And in fact, particularly if we try really, really hard to get rid of things, they actually come back more. And kind of worse, and we feel worse about them. And so what acceptance-based treatments do is really try to target that phenomenon explicitly by helping people to learn how to relate to their internal experiences differently. So the difference between, for instance, if I were right now having the thought, I don't think I'm making enough sense. And then I thought, oh no, I can't have that thought that I'm not making sense. And what should I do? That's right. That's going to make me more anxious. Whereas if I noticed that I had that thought and then maybe took a breath and maybe tried to say it again and hope that it's clear and hope that it's making sense, that would be more of an acceptance-based thing. These thoughts will come up. I might feel a little anxious. I'm doing something that matters to me, and so I'm going to keep doing that.
So you just accept what can go wrong and move on and learn the skill to deal with it.
Exactly. Correct? And I'll just say one more thing about acceptance, that sometimes I think people hear acceptance and they think resignation. So they think that that means like it's always going to be like this. I panic and I'm going to keep panicking and it will always be that way. And that's actually not what we mean by acceptance. What we mean is this is here in this moment. And there's no way around this particular moment and the way it is. I have panic now. And I can do any of a number of things while I have this panic that matter to me and still engage in life. And that can include things like going to therapy and doing other things. So it's not a passive thing. It's more of a not struggling and not fighting, because that doesn't make it better.
Okay. So there are all sorts of different kinds of treatments for anxiety disorders and depression. Acceptance and commitment therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, they all have their own alphabet soup that goes with them. So let's take a few of those and talk just briefly, explain how they help people with anxiety and depression. So ACT, or acceptance and commitment therapy.
And actually we call it ACT.
ACT, okay.
So that's the first thing
okay.
to know.
Yes,
okay. Which is confusing. So acceptance and commitment therapy is another, again, so all of those treatments you just mentioned, I would classify as types of acceptance-based behavior therapy. So I would say that they are all very closely related. Often, if you're seeing people in practice, often they're going to be pulling from multiple ones of these. So therapists really vary in terms of how much they maybe stick to one of the alphabet soup treatments versus draw from them in a sort of consistent way. So I'll say a little bit about each one of them, but okay. just I think it's useful to know that mm-hmm. people kind of mix and match a little bit, and certainly that's what I do in my own work. So ACT is a treatment that we've drawn from a lot and that follows some of the things I was just saying. So it's particularly focused on targeting this kind of way that we respond to our internal experiences that's critical and reactive, and also that they use the term fused, so sort of seeing our thoughts and feelings as defining ourselves as opposed to thoughts and feelings as things that happen as we continue on in our lives, and then also engaging more fully in life. So that's essentially what ACT is, and I can keep going down the list. So dialectical behavior therapy is a extensive treatment that was developed initially by Marshall Linehan really to help clients who are struggling with multiple problems, particularly with extreme emotion dysregulation and a lot of problematic behaviors that come from that, so people engaging in self-harm or other kinds of impulsive behaviors. And it's a treatment that includes both group skills building, including mindfulness skills and emotion regulation skills and interpersonal skills, and then also individual psychotherapy. And the last one you mentioned is mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. That's a treatment that was developed specifically to help people who have recurrent major depression. So one of the things about depressive experiences is that they tend to recur. So people recover from an episode and then can have it again, which can be very frustrating and can sort of make difficulties worse, understandably. And so what MBCT does is it teaches a skill, particularly the skill of mindfulness, that helps people to recognize the cues when they're cycling back down so that they can use their skills and then not go back into a depressive episode. And it's also been used more widely for some anxiety disorders as well, because sort of similar skills are useful.
So a patient might wonder which treatment would work best for his or her specific disorder. Is that per disorder, or is it a combination of the individual and the disorder?
That's a great question, and I would say that I would say it's actually probably focused more on the individual, and I would also say the individual therapist match. So one thing that I always encourage people who come to me looking for referrals is really meet with a therapist, meet with several therapists, ask them how they understand your difficulties and how they understand treatment, and work with someone who you feel like you're going to be able to work with and who seems to be relating to you in a way that you think is going to be affirming and is going to help you make meaningful changes. So So I would lean more towards those things. Like I said, people do kind of combine these treatments a bit. I think some differences are mindfulness-based cognitive therapy tends to involve a great deal of mindfulness practice and longer practices, like 35, 40 minutes. So a little bit depending on if someone has time to do that, wants to do that, if that seems to sort of resonate with them, versus the other treatments which have some shorter practices and are a little bit more flexible. Mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is also often done in a group setting. The others are both group and individual. So I think those kinds of things would go into the decision making.
Now, let me ask you something, too, that I've heard CBT called a short-term 12 to 16-week kind
right.
of therapy. Do these fall in kind of the same time frames?
It's variable. So dialectical behavior therapy, actually, when it's done for people that have the kind of extreme challenges and sort of lifelong challenges, has actually been done in a much longer term. So people can do DBT for a year. One might go through the skills groups over that time or for much longer than that. But if it's being used for something that is sort of less ingrained and less extensive, then it might be a little shorter. ACT has been used at really varying degrees. So there are studies that look at 4-session treatments for ACT. And there are studies that have looked at more like 12 to 16. The treatment that we do for generalized anxiety disorder, the research that we've done on it, it was a 16-session individual treatment. But we're also very interested. Right now I'm doing a study with my students where we're trying to condense it down to an hour and a half informational workshop to see if that's preventative, to see if that helps people. So it's going to depend a little bit sort of how strong the habits are that people have built.
And how long it takes to undo them.
Exactly.
So what challenges do patients face, and how do they overcome them or manage them when they're starting treatment particularly, and then throughout?
Sure. The first challenge I think that perhaps people listening are aware of is finding a good therapist. So I recommend the ADAA website and other resources. So, you know, and asking people and going to multiple places. In terms of starting treatment, again, I think an important part is developing a good relationship with the therapist, being as open and honest as you can be, which is very challenging with a stranger, and particularly when you're feeling vulnerable. So one of the hard things about therapy, I think, is that we don't go into it when we're at our best. And so that's challenging in and of itself. I have tremendous respect for the clients who come to see me for that reason. I think it takes a lot of courage to come and be vulnerable in that state. I think then other things that come up is that, you know, I talked about how sort of avoiding these feelings doesn't really make them go away. So that means we sort of accept them and sort of turn towards them instead of away from them. Well, turning towards painful feelings is not an easy thing. And so I think it can be painful. It can be evocative to do this work. It can be anxiety provoking. One of the things we'll help clients do is approach things that they've been avoiding so they can live a fuller life. Well, there's a reason people have been avoiding these things. It's because they're super scary. And so going towards them is anxiety provoking. People will experience anxiety. What we know is that anxiety doesn't last, and that actually when you approach things, what happens is that you learn that they're not as bad as you thought they were, and that you're more capable than you thought you were, and so that goes down, and that's the wonderful benefit of this, and one of the reasons that I really enjoy working with people with this approach and with these kinds of presenting difficulties, because we can really see tremendous change in people. And, you know, and it's hard work. And one other thing I would say, too, is that because these are habits, because we've developed them by practicing them over and over, then we need to practice new habits, which means it takes some time. It takes some time outside of session as well.
So when somebody is going through treatment, do family members or friends play a role, or the people around them, is that a factor that influences them?
Absolutely. And you know, one of the things that we certainly know is that people experiencing anxiety and depression, that affects relationships a great deal. And relationships affect anxiety and depression. And so sometimes I think people might bring in a family member or a partner, even to session, to maybe teach them a little bit about anxiety so they understand better. There are some approaches where we would involve people very explicitly. I think even if we aren't involving people explicitly, that certainly relationships are affected. One of the things we know from our research with generalized anxiety disorder is that people report really significant improvements in terms of the quality of their relationships and how satisfied they are with the way they are being in their relationships. So we definitely see those things change. And I think social support can be incredibly helpful.
What can someone do today who wants to start therapy?
So certainly, again, the first thing is looking for a therapist, and identifying things and meeting with multiple people. And then, you know, beyond that, I would also say that I think there are some things that people can do in terms of applying, for instance, mindfulness and acceptance, which is that we can start practicing this new skill of noticing and sort of recognizing that our thoughts and feelings arise, that they change, that we might in one moment think we're doing a terrible job at something, but if we're paying attention and kind of keeping our attention broad instead of narrow, because anxiety can make us narrow in on negative things, but if we broaden, we might notice, oh wait, this thing went kind of well. So that there are ways to kind of start practicing that even on their own. And it can be as simple really as in the middle of a situation, sort of noticing that anxiety has arisen and pausing and noticing the way you feel in your body, noticing your breath, taking a moment, allowing it, allowing whatever you're feeling, and thinking about what matters to you and kind of moving on with that. So those are just little changes, and then absolutely help of a therapist. There are also very good self-help books, including our self-help book, but others as well, that can guide people with mindfulness and anxiety.
Good. Well, we'll just take a breath, and I'll thank you very much, Dr. Romer. This is Jean Kaplan-Tigro for ADAA.